Today on Against the Grain, Israeli universities are heralded in the West for their liberalism and diversity, but critics assert that they're a crucial part of Israel's war-making machine. Israeli Jewish academic Maya Wind argues that even before the formation of the State of Israel, universities played a key role in the project of Zionist state building. She makes the case for an academic boycott and discusses the demonization of boycott divestment sanctions against Israel as it gathers strength. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. As the Israeli military destroys the Palestinian universities of the Gaza Strip, a look at the role of Israeli universities and their relationship with the military and State of Israel, the subject of the book Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom, which is published by Verso. Its author, Maya Wind, is Killam Postdoctoral Fellow in the Department of Anthropology at the University of British Columbia. Maya, I'd like to start with this. Israeli universities have a reputation in the West as bastions of academic freedom and liberalism. There are many in Israel who oppose an academic boycott against its universities, who cite the idea that universities are an important location of dissent. What is this reputation for academic freedom actually based on? Where does it come from?
What we're seeing now also unfold with the genocide in Gaza, but also more broadly in the United States and elsewhere in the West, is a sort of parroting of Israeli narratives, often uncritically and seldom with evidence. And we're seeing that same dynamic unfold with regards to Israeli universities. And so if you look at materials, promotional materials and others produced by Israeli universities themselves, where they narrate their own story as institutions, it is one of Israeli academia being a progressive space, a liberal space, a uniquely almost democratic space. And so this narrative really travels very well over to the Western academic community and the Western community more broadly, where this narrative is sort of accepted at face value. And I think this is true in general for universities. Our common understanding of academia and of universities are as these special spaces that are at the forefront of free and critical thinking, debate. But in the case of Israeli universities, many of the facts underlying these claims are not adequately challenged. And so I came to write this book in order to really investigate some of these claims.
And would you say this reputation that Israeli universities are, you know, unusually free is a recent notion or one that has a longer history?
That's an excellent question. I think it is part of a broader history of the Zionist project, both of the Zionist movement and then later the State of Israel, sort of narrating itself and legitimizing itself in Western discourse and in Western understandings. So Israel, using very typical colonial language, has always sort of marketed itself as the only democracy in the Middle East, right? As a sea of civility amidst quote-unquote, uncivil Arabs, right? And so the narration of Israeli universities as these uniquely democratic structures in a broader landscape of the Middle East kind of is actually part of that broader narrative and that broader project. And I think it's interesting to reflect on those of us based in universities in North America, for instance, how many of our universities have joint research programs, student exchange programs, a whole host of exchanges with Israeli universities, and how many of our institutions, our same institutions, have parallel programming with Arab institutions or other institutions in the Middle East. So that's also worth reflecting on in sort of the exceptionality and the narration of Israeli universities in the West.
Well, given what you're describing, this self-projection of the Israeli universities and a projection that's very willingly consumed in the West, in the United States, that Israeli universities are this sort of sanctuary for academic freedom and diversity and liberalism. What is the way that Israeli universities describe themselves domestically when they're not addressing a kind of Western foreign audience? How do they see their own relationship to the Israeli state? By definition, academic freedom obviously means freedom from the intrusions and the agenda of the state of that society. How would you say universities, by and large, in Israel see their own relationship to the Israeli state?
Right. So you're pointing to a disjuncture that certainly exists. The Israeli Academy has certainly long promoted two very different narratives, one sort of internal to Israeli society and one that is outward facing to the international community. And within Israel, university administrations and the vast majority of Israeli academics tell a very different story than the one that they tell when facing the international academic community. And internally, time and again, Israeli universities repress Palestinian protest, curtail Palestinian critique on their own campuses, and they're coalescing increasingly, especially over the last two decades, not only with the Israeli government, but with the Israeli far right, in further limiting what is permissible to study, to speak about on campus. And then when facing the international community, they tell a decidedly different story, especially in the face of the growing worldwide support for the academic boycott. Israeli universities claim they are bastions of multiculturalism and democracy, where critique and dissent are welcome. And so there is a real gulf between these two narrations.
Well, can you describe for us the history of universities in, I was going to say Israel, but some of this actually predates the official founding of the State of Israel in 1948. What role have universities played in the larger Zionist project?
So before the Israeli state was even founded, the Zionist movement actually founded three universities, and explicitly as state-building institutions. Hebrew University was established in 1918, and it was the first university of the Zionist movement, and it was established as a center for the formation of a new collective Jewish Zionist nation. And it was strategically built on a remote outpost at the apex of Mount Scopus, outside of the center of Jerusalem at the time, to really stake symbolic and political sort of material claim to the entire city of Jerusalem. And then shortly thereafter, in the 1920s and 30s, the Zionist movement founded the Technion in Haifa and the Weizmann Institute in Rehovot. And these were established to sort of advance the scientific and technological development of Israel as a Jewish state. And so these three institutions already were positioned as state building. And then in the lead up to the 1948 war and the establishment of Israel, they were really directly recruited to support Zionist territorial expansion. And so the Haganah militia, which was the leading Zionist militia and what would become the foundation of the Israeli military, established a science corps, which opened bases on all three campuses to research and refine military capabilities. Faculty and students participated in this too, and they developed and designed and manufactured weapons on their campuses to support Palestinian expulsion in the Nakba, right, which is the catastrophe where over two-thirds of the Palestinian population were expelled in order to establish the State of Israel. And so these campuses, these initial three universities were already formed as state-building institutions. And then the institutions that were founded after the state, and this is something that I trace in the book, were founded as sort of to anchor the continual territorial expansion of the Israeli state and the sort of demographic engineering where Israel seeks to continually shrink lands in Palestinian possession, Palestinian territorial contiguity, and at the same time expand Jewish settlement and expand Jewish population distribution. And Israel, the Israeli state, doesn't shy away from this project. In fact, it officially terms it Judaization. This is an official Israeli state program. And the universities established post-1948 were all established to anchor Judaization programs regionally. So that's true of the University of Haifa in the Galilee, the region where we have the largest Palestinian population within 1948 borders. And that's true in the Nakab, what Israel calls the Negev, which is the most sparsely populated area by Jewish Israelis. And so Ben-Gurion University there was founded as a pull for more Jewish Israeli settlers to come and inhabit the land. That's true. And then, of course, that's also true of the latest university, Ariel University, which is at the heart of the Ariel settlement, which is one of the largest illegal settlements in the heart of the occupied West Bank. And the founders of that university, this is the most recently accredited Israeli university, the founders of that university explicitly said that the intention to establish a university in Ariel was not only to bring more settlers to settle this settlement, but also to legitimize it. And so, and they were successful. And so really what I trace in the book is that over the course of a century, Israeli universities were founded as land grab institutions, and they were strategically placed in order to expand the state's Judaization program.
Right, and you also document how in the course of the establishment of the State of Israel and the Nakba, the mass expulsion of the Palestinians, that universities and academic institutions played a role, even as that catastrophe was unfolding, to loot and appropriate materials, academic materials, books from Palestinian homes and educational institutions. Can you tell us about that in particular?
So the Hebrew University was established, as I mentioned, in Mount Scopus in East Jerusalem. But what happened during the Nakba was actually an opportunity for that university to eventually expand both its property and its campus. And so what happened in 1948 was that the majority of the Palestinian population of West Jerusalem were expelled and fled Zionist militia campaigns. And what happened immediately after, still during the war, but immediately after Palestinians were expelled from West Jerusalem, the Israeli government granted authority to the National Library and Hebrew University to actually appropriate books from Palestinian homes, libraries, educational and religious institutions, all books left behind by Palestinian war refugees. And both Palestinian and even some Israeli scholars have documented this, that Hebrew University organized teams of librarians, even students and administrators, to actually trail Israeli soldiers to comb through Palestinian neighborhoods, searching for these libraries and private troves of book collections. And so over the course of this expedition, they appropriated 30,000 Palestinian books, thousands of newspapers, journals. And what is important to know about this is that the Oriental Division of the National Library, which by the way remains a central research library of Middle East Studies at Hebrew University, still holds thousands of looted Palestinian books to this day. And so Palestinian families have actually tried to reclaim their property for some decades now. But as Israel frequently does, the National Library reclassified the books as abandoned property, removed the names of the owners of the books. And so Hebrew University and the National Library are still categorically refusing to acknowledge or take any responsibility for continuing to house looted Palestinian property in violation, of course, of the Geneva Convention and international law.
How are Israeli universities funded? What is their funding relationship with the state?
So in the book, I really investigated the 8 major public universities in Israel. That is the vast majority. We have one private university as well, IDC Herzliya. But the book really focuses on the sort of foundational main 8 public institutions. So they are funded through the Council of Higher Education in Israel. So these are public institutions that have close relationships to the state. But it's important to note that it is not just the funding that is structuring their relationship to the state. Israeli university administrations have established close ties with the state and have done so willingly. And many of Israeli academics themselves choose to cooperate with the state in all sorts of ways, whether it's by establishing specialized tailored degree programs for Israeli soldiers and Israeli security personnel, whether it's conducting research in the service of the Israeli military in order to more effectively and illegally govern the occupied Palestinian territory, whether it's in supporting the repression of their Palestinian colleagues or their Palestinian students, or even critical Jewish Israeli colleagues and students, from conducting the kind of research that would be critical of the state. So it is really not only the institutions, but it's the people that inhabit them that really make them operate in service of the Israeli state and its projects.
I'm speaking with Maya Wind. She's a scholar of Israeli militarism. We're discussing Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You've been describing for us the history of Israeli universities and their centrality to the state-building project of Israel. I wanted to ask you about the history of Palestinian students attending Israeli universities. How long has that gone on, and what sort of relationship do Palestinian students tend to have with these institutions?
Yeah, so it is important to note the Israeli military has recently destroyed all 11 of the Palestinian universities in the Gaza Strip. And Palestinian scholar Karma Nabulsi has called this part of a project of scholasticide. And this is really, it's important to note, there has been a war on Palestinian education for over 75 years. And that is because Israel has always regarded Palestinian education as a threat to its rule, and has really targeted it at every turn, and even internally for Palestinian citizens of the state of Israel. And so from the outset, as soon as Israel was established, it established a very tight control over Palestinian schools. It is also worth noting that Palestinian citizens of the state of Israel themselves were placed under military rule between 1948 and 1966. And so during the military rule, Israel slowly began to allow Palestinian students in very small numbers to enroll at its universities, but it monitored them incredibly closely and worked with the state to ensure that they were not mobilizing in any way. And they were. They were mobilizing on campuses. And that history and that kind of cooperation with the Israeli security apparatuses to monitor and to surveil Palestinian students, that practice has a long afterlife, and it persists to this day, not only because representatives of the Ministry of Education in Israel continue to collaborate and to be in consultation with and cooperate with the Israeli Shin Bet, the Israeli Security Agency, and other apparatuses of the Israeli security state, but also because the university administrations themselves continue to police Palestinian student presence and speech and mobilization on their own campuses. And so we see that in a number of ways. One is that Palestinian citizen students are summoned to disciplinary committees at far higher rates than their Jewish Israeli peers. Their student groups are routinely denied permits to hold events. So for example, the Nakba, which is right the most foundational event that has produced Palestinian citizenship and is the most foundational event for Palestinians and for the Palestinian experience, Palestinian student groups are consistently denied the opportunity to hold commemoration events for the Nakba or other cultural and political events that really take up the Nakba. There's a lot of Nakba denialism in Israel, right? Because it really undermines the sort of foundational myths of the Israeli state. And so Palestinian students are routinely curtailed in their speech and in their ability to mobilize on Israeli campuses.
How do Israeli universities contribute to the state of Israel's propaganda machine in an active way?
So Hezbollah is what Israel calls its state propaganda. And Israeli universities have stepped in time and again to aid this programming. And they do that in a number of ways. But one of the ways that they do this is they actually have institutes and resources and syllabi that they put towards this towards a state project. And so one example is the Comper Center in the University of Haifa that produces propaganda and talking points in order to help the Israeli state rehabilitate its image in the international community and evade accountability for its war crimes and routine violations of Palestinian rights and international law. And so the Comper Center is an interesting example because it actually recruits Israeli students. They have a program called Ambassadors Online, which started as an extracurricular activity, but now actually is a accredited university course. So students can actually gain university credit for producing propaganda. It's taught not only by faculty, but also by Israeli state personnel. And final projects for this course include actually producing content that it can be used by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Another example is the Institute for National Security Studies, the INSS, at Tel Aviv University, which is sort of Israel's leading think tank. But it's based in at Tel Aviv University, and they too have entire programming where they bring in military and state experts as fellows to cooperate with faculty and graduate students to produce materials to help Israel evade accountability. And one of the most recent examples of this we actually saw with the very courageous and meticulous case brought against Israel to the ICJ by South Africa, accusing Israel of committing genocide against the Palestinian people. And the INSS immediately snapped into action and began to produce material, including through the use of drawing on Israeli legal expertise, to try and produce talking points for the Israeli state in defending itself against the South African case at the ICJ. So you were really seeing across the board that Israeli universities are stepping up and putting their resources, their institutes, their faculty and students in the service of Israeli state propaganda.
And you write in your book that there is a longer history of the discipline of law in Israel, in Israeli universities, being mobilized to justify Israeli state politics, including justifying things like extrajudicial killings. Tell us more about that.
Because Israel has been illegally governing the Palestinian population through military occupation for decades, it has had to develop a corpus of legal interpretations to sanction this permanent military regime. And so this is true especially since the Second Palestinian Intifada, as the Israeli military waged offensives on the Gaza Strip, campaigns in the West Bank to subdue protesters and insurgents, it really developed legal doctrines and interpretations of international humanitarian law to justify a whole host of practices, including, as you said, extrajudicial assassinations, torture, the deployment of what would otherwise be considered disproportionate use of force against civilian populations, or in other words, war crimes. And so faculties of law across Israeli universities stepped in to facilitate this legal innovation in service of the Israeli military, in service of the Israeli security state. They were joined by ethicists from philosophy departments, criminologists, right? So there's a whole host of Israeli scholars who have subordinated their own inquiry to service the Israeli state. And they're really working to theorize and provide moral and legal justification for Israeli policies, for Israeli military operations, both in real time and also during the international legal probes that frequently follow Israeli military offensives, really all to shield Israel from accountability and permit the Israeli military to continue to carry out war crimes against the Palestinians with impunity. And so I document some of these examples in my book of legal scholars and others really subordinating their research in order to make this possible.
Well, undoubtedly, all of these things would have intensified since October and the assault on Gaza. But I wanted to ask you about the limits to what academics can study in Israeli institutions, given the picture that you're painting here of, you know, multiple disciplines in service to the Israeli state, the active production of propaganda by universities for the state of Israel, you know, all of this legal apparatus you're discussing. What are the limits to what people can study, whether they are Palestinian or Israeli Jews, and what happens if they cross the line?
During the first decades of the Israeli state, there was really very tight control established over Israeli universities. In fact, some leaders of Israeli universities were not even academics at all. They were handpicked by Ben-Gurion, by the Prime Minister Ben-Gurion himself, and they were sometimes military leaders or other statesmen. And this is throughout the 1950s and 60s, and so there was a really close cooperation, and the Israeli government really established a very tight control over its universities. And then really, in many ways, for the first time in the late 70s, and then really in 80s and 90s, there were new openings created by very courageous, both Palestinian and some critical Jewish Israeli scholars, who really tried to open up sort of very foundational questions about the structures of violence and the history of the establishment of the Israeli state in ways that challenged the Israeli national ethos and the Israeli myths about its own founding and how it came into existence. Folks here might be familiar with the new historians and others who really went into Israeli archives in the 1980s to explore these histories and really found through recently declassified documents in Israeli archives evidence for the premeditated mass expulsion of Palestinians in the Nakba, of massacres. And it's important to note these documents and this research was really only reinforcing what Palestinian scholars and Palestinian researchers had already laid bare through their own oral histories and through their own research. But in Israeli society, Palestinian research of that kind was just totally ignored and sidelined. And so the sort of discourse about the Nakba really only emerged when Jewish Israelis reinforced this Palestinian research and brought some of this data into the Israeli discussion for the first time. And so the backlash against Israel's new historians was really a turning point because they faced very serious campaigns of harassment and silencing, and most of them, in fact all but one, ended up leaving the Israeli Academy, most of them moving to the United Kingdom. And since that time, as Palestinian citizens have continued to mobilize and to continue to insist on critical scientific research into the Nakba and into the structures of violence of the Israeli state, the consensus has only become more strictly enforced on Israeli campuses. And the limits placed on this kind of critical research has only gotten more strict. And that's true in particular throughout the last two decades, since the Second Palestinian Intifada and since Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel too have insisted on their right to challenge the kind of foundational ideas about the Israeli state, including by really investigating the Israeli state and its formation through the lens of settler colonialism. And so what we're seeing is that over the last two decades, the enforcement of this consensus has just become much more strict, and Palestinian and other critical Jewish Israeli scholars are being increasingly either driven out of the academy or having very serious restrictions placed on their ability to write and to research and to speak. And Palestinian scholars have already documented this, and I also interviewed Palestinian scholars based at Israeli universities who really described the sort of McCarthyism and the retribution that they face both from administrators and also the pushback that they're getting from their colleagues that is really making their critical work untenable.
Part of the project of state building is often or inevitably about origins, right? And I wanted to ask you about the field of archaeology, how the field of archaeology in Israel has become highly politicized. Can you tell us about that and to the degree to which there are any scholars who are pushing back?
Yeah, so like legal studies, archaeology has become a discipline in Israel that is really subordinating its research to the needs of the state. And Palestinian anthropologist Nadia Abulhaj is one of the first to really document this in her own research. She did a very deep study of Israeli archaeologists and the ways in which their scholarship and the ways that they conduct archaeological digs, and this is true across the occupied Palestinian territory and across what is now Israel, contravenes scientific standards for archaeological research. So they remove artifacts that are from Islamic periods in order to create a new sort of evidentiary terrain that establishes Israel as a Jewish state and sort of construct sort of biblically based narratives about the supposedly uninterrupted and continual Jewish presence on the land as a way to legitimize the Israeli state. And what I looked at in my research is really the ways in which all archaeology departments across and institutes across Israeli universities all actually conduct research in service of the continual expulsion of Palestinians from their lands using archaeological digs as a pretext. And so we see, for example, in occupied East Jerusalem, in the neighborhood of Silwan, just outside the old city walls, where Elad, which is a Israeli settler organization whose explicit mission is to expel Palestinians from East Jerusalem and replace them with Jewish Israeli settlers, they have a whole project that they, an archaeological project, they have where they really conduct digs in order to claim that this neighborhood and this territory is actually should be in Jewish hands based on sort of biblical narratives. And this has been shown time and again to be unscientific. They remove artifacts that that contradict their narratives. And this is an explicitly political and unscientific project. And yet this has not stopped a number of Israeli universities, including Hebrew University, to cooperate with this settler organization that is actively working to expropriate Palestinian lands and homes under the aegis of archaeological research.
Mai Wind is my guest. We're discussing Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So Maya, you've been describing many intersecting ways that Israeli academic institutions have, in their way, bolstered, provided material for the Zionist state and the Zionist project. Some of those are in the realm of ideology and propaganda, but I wanted to ask you more directly about the role that Israeli universities have played in military research from the time, at least, of the formation of the State of Israel.
The military capabilities of the Israeli state were from the outset entangled with the rise of Israeli universities. And so actually, really, Israeli universities, from even before the State of Israel was founded, made possible the formation of Israeli military industries, and they really helped to birth them. And this really began in the lead-up to the 1948 war with the Science Corps that really operated out of the first three Israeli campuses to produce research and to develop weaponry, including, by the way, biological weaponry to poison the water sources of Palestinian villages and towns to aid their expulsion and to make it impossible for them to return. And since that time, Israeli universities continue to support and to sustain Israel's leading military corporations and global exporters, including Rafael, Elbit Systems, Israeli Aerospace Industries. These were initially state-owned military corporations that were really birthed and sustained by laboratories and departments of engineering in across Israeli universities, but particularly the Technion Institute in Haifa. And the universities continue to cooperate. They offer scholarships, and they allow these corporations to establish laboratories, to fund research. They produce research in service of these military corporations. And it's important to note that these weapons companies produce primarily for weaponry for the Israeli military. So these are weapons that are used to maintain the illegal occupation of the occupied Palestinian territory, to continue to govern Palestinians with the military, and of course to kill them, as we're seeing now in Gaza as we speak. And Israeli universities are operating very directly to provide the military capabilities that Israel needs in order to maintain the occupation.
In discussing Israeli universities and their role in supporting the state of Israel, inevitably this ends up informing the question of an academic boycott, because for a number of years, people around the world have called for an academic boycott as a way of putting some pressure on the Israeli state. The degree to which academic freedom takes place within Israeli institutions, therefore, becomes a central point in the debate over BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions. How would you assess the degree to which there are significant numbers of dissenting academics working in Israeli universities today, whether Jewish, Israeli, or Palestinian, and whether you believe the argument holds up that an academic boycott would therefore be counterproductive?
Yeah, this is an important question, because it's something that we hear again and again from those who oppose the academic boycott. So let me start by saying that the Palestinian campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel, PACB, that came out with its first call 20 years ago at this point, in 2004, their call was not to boycott, and never is, and remains as such. Their call was to boycott Israeli academic institutions, not individuals. And that is because of the institutional ties that Israeli universities have to the Israeli state, and the ways in which Israeli universities sustain the occupation and sustain Israeli apartheid and Israeli settler colonialism, and the violation of Palestinian rights. And so what modeled after the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa is the Palestinian civil society is calling to hold Israeli universities accountable and is really asking the international community to help guide Israeli academics to demand that their institutions sever ties from the Israeli state and from Israeli apartheid. And by the way, in South Africa, this did happen. Some white scholars and white students in traditionally white institutions in South Africa did heed the call from the African National Congress to, in fact, demand that their universities sever ties from the apartheid regime. And so what the Palestinian civil society is asking from the international community in this call for the academic boycott is to guide Israeli academics to demand the same. So this call is really about institutional accountability. It is not about a targeting of individual Israeli scholars. And in fact, it is important to note, I myself am a Jewish Israeli scholar, the Palestinian call for boycott unequivocally and very clearly, and anyone can look this up, extends an invitation to Israelis of conscience to join the Palestinian Movement for Liberation as partners in this struggle. And some of us, I'm part of a group called Boycott From Within, there are Israeli scholars and Israeli activists who have joined this call, and we are invited to do so and to participate in calling for the accountability of our own institutions and holding them accountable. And so this is an invitation to not only to scholars of conscience around the world, but to Israelis of conscience to join the movement for Palestinian rights.
How much are those calls resonating within Israeli academia, and to what degree are Israeli academics arguing that an academic boycott is misguided or wrongheaded?
Unfortunately, the overwhelming response from Israeli academics thus far, over the last 20 years of the call for the boycott, has been one of indignant opposition. And I think it is unfortunate because many Israelis refuse to accept that Palestinian civil society is actually making demands on them. But what I would love for us to consider is that this is actually what Palestinian civil society and Palestinian scholars are giving Israelis is an incredible gift. It is a roadmap to participate ethically in the struggle for liberation. And this is not only for Palestinian liberation, but for Israeli liberation as well, because Israelis cannot truly be free as long as Palestinians are not free. And so rather than understand the academic boycott as a punitive measure, we need to understand it as an invitation and as a call for accountability. The academic boycott is not seeking to punish anyone. It is seeking to hold accountable institutions for their participation in violence and in sustaining apartheid. But so Israeli academics, for the most part, have been staunchly in opposition of the boycott and have tried to counter it in the international arena. But what instead we might invite Israeli scholars to do, and what the academic boycott is inviting the international academic community to do, is to help guide Israeli academics to hold their institutions accountable and to cease being in service of Israeli apartheid and instead be what academic institutions should be, which is anchors for freedom, academic freedom and all types of freedom, critical thought and justice. And so we can remake Israeli universities as institutions in service of freedom for all and justice for all, including academic freedom, if we adhere to the boycott and sever the ties between Israeli academic institutions and the Israeli state.
In the United States, the assault on Gaza has really become kind of a turning point in terms of the flowering of a social movement against Israeli apartheid and U.S. support for it. On the other hand, in Israel, the population has moved to the right. Is there any potential for this ultimately to be a turning point, or is that too optimistic?
As I mentioned, I'm Jewish Israeli, and I've spent many years working and organizing within Israel, within Israeli society, seeking to create change and to challenge the status quo and to challenge Israeli thinking and to urge Israelis to see the humanity of Palestinians and to recognize that our freedom is bound up with the freedom of Palestinians. As you said, unfortunately, Israel has only moved to the right. And this is true before October 7, but it is certainly true after. And this is why I have really come to be a proponent of BDS, is because I unfortunately only see the possibility for change coming from intervention by the international community. Israelis will not change en masse in time. And the time is already too late. And what we are seeing unfold right now in Gaza, with over 30,000 Palestinians killed, over 11,500 children, the total decimation of Palestinian civil society institutions in Gaza, including all of its universities, we are seeing that there is no significant opposition to speak of within Israeli society to this genocide. Quite the opposite. There is active participation, active recruitment, And so this is why it is absolutely urgent for the international community to step in, including through the academic boycott, for Israelis to hear from the international community that what they are doing is absolutely unacceptable. And they unfortunately so far are not listening to Palestinians and to the Palestinian Liberation Movement, but they might just listen to the international community if forced to reckon with their accountability for violence. And that is what the academic boycott is trying to do.
I'd like to ask you about arrangements which you referred to earlier between U.S. academic institutions and Israeli ones in the context of the assault on Gaza. There are all sorts of joint ventures between universities in the U.S. and Israel, including Columbia has a dual degree program with Tel Aviv University. Cornell University has a joint institute in New York with the Technion, that's the Israel Institute of Technology. Given that in the United States, in the last few months, it seems like there is a wave of social movements that really has been unprecedented against U.S. support of Israel, and university campuses have been a key site for those protests. And of course, there's been tremendous repression that has come down. But do you think that these arrangements, these sort of joint ventures between U.S. and Israeli academic institutions are proving or could prove particularly vulnerable right now?
Absolutely. The amazing and growing movement on U.S. college campuses for justice in Palestine is remarkable. And we're seeing that campus after campus, which is why it's being repressed and criminalized at every turn, precisely because it is growing and it is powerful. And I think, unfortunately for those of us based in institutions of higher education in the United States, we are deeply implicated, but through the collaborations of our institutions with Israeli universities, we too become implicated, not only in the current genocide in Gaza, but also in Israeli settler colonialism and apartheid and the violation of Palestinian rights more broadly. But this also gives us an opportunity to intervene and to intervene effectively. We actually have so much power, those of us based in the university system in the United States. We have the power to really sever these ties between our institutions and Israeli academic institutions and to cease the normalization and the legitimacy of these institutions and interrupt business as usual and to really send the message to Israeli academics and to Israeli students and to Israeli university administrations that they must sever their ties from the Israeli government. I think it is worth noting that not a single Israeli university administration has come out in a call to cease the bombardment and the destruction of Palestinian universities, of their Palestinian counterparts, right, in the Gaza Strip right now. And nor has any of them come out in support of Palestinian academic freedom in Gaza or in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, where Palestinian universities are subject to routine Israeli military raids, to the abduction and arrest and torture of their faculty and students. And so, again, we must understand that academic freedom does not exist unless it applies to all. And so what we are fighting for here through the academic boycott is for true academic freedom for all living under Israeli governance. And those of us here in North American institutions have an incredible opportunity to participate in the movement for true freedom for all.
Let me end by asking you if you could give us your assessment of the growing power of academic boycott and more broadly boycott, divestment, sanctions as a strategy. It's certainly been demonized in the United States by those in power. How would you assess its strength at this point?
The BDS movement is gaining significant traction worldwide, which is precisely, as you said, why it is being criminalized and demonized. So the fact that 34 states, I believe, have anti-BDS laws at this point in the United States, speaks to how powerful this movement has become and how much support it has across college campuses and across the United States more broadly. And the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement is an incredibly principled, deeply strategic movement that really seeks through nonviolent means to hold Israel accountable and to bring about change and to end Israeli apartheid and to grant full recognition of the rights of the Palestinian people as stipulated in international law. And so because it is so effective and because it is so deeply principled and because it is gaining traction, for all of those reasons, the Israeli state is incredibly concerned about the BDS movement, and Israeli allies, including U.S. government and Zionist institutions in the United States, have really declared a war on this movement. And when their attempt to delegitimize it and to demonize it and to slander it was falling short of interrupting its growth, they moved to criminalize it and to actually criminalize BDS. And so this is an indication of just how powerful this movement is, because it is a value-based movement. It really is a movement for freedom, and it's really hard to argue with.
Maya Nguyen, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Maya Nguyen is the author of Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom. You can find a link to that book at againstthegrain.org. She's the Killam Postdoctoral Fellow in the Department of Anthropology at the University of British Columbia and a scholar of Israeli militarism. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.